This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Everyone takes the ferry in Istanbul. It's how the city gets from one side to the other. But stay on board a little longer and you arrive at the Prince's Islands, a cluster of nine islands southeast of Istanbul in the Sea of Marmara. Once places of exile for royals, today they're something else entirely. And on the island of Büyükada, local businesswoman Mina Akdar and her family have been enjoying the unique pace of life here for generations.
Büyükada is a place where time stands still. And as soon as you step onto the island, you feel at peace and you feel relaxed. Walking around, exploring different beaches, I think it's just wonderful for anyone who's interested in beautiful places.
Just an hour from the hustle and bustle of the city, yet a world away, the Prince's Islands are a place where doing less somehow feels like more. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm one of the producers here at The Briefing Room, and I'm going to tell you a little bit of the backstory to what you're about to hear. 5 years ago, I was making a documentary about radical Islam in the United States, and I came across a man named Yunus Abdullah Muhammad. He ran an extremist group called Revolution Muslim. Now, fast forward to today, and Yunus Abdullah Muhammad now goes by his birth name, Jesse Morton. He's renounced extremism. He's become de-radicalized. He's been to jail and he's been out again. And in the program you're about to hear, he tells us his remarkable story.
I was faced with the choice of either going back to the United States to face the music or to travel and to join a jihadist group. And I had actually made arrangements to leave at midnight that night with a Quranic instructor I had met in a very small mosque in Casablanca. And I found myself one night making a prayer that a Muslim makes when he has a major decision to make. However, when I got up from this prayer, I had to walk by the crib where my two infant children were sleeping. And I saw them sleeping, looked at my wife sleeping in the bed, and I realized that I needed my family, and my family needed me.
Jesse Morton was, until 2011, one of America's leading jihadist preachers. He was the US counterpart to this British man.
My dear Muslims, we do raise funds for the widows and the orphans, but in the eyes of this government, that is called terrorist funding.
British extremist Anjem Chowdhury. The two men shared an ideology and were part of the same network. With Anjem Chowdhury about to be sentenced in London next week for inciting people to travel to Syria to join Islamic State, Jesse Morton has decided to go public about his part in the Western Jihad.
Everybody inside of radical or violent extremist movements has a role, and they adopt a role based upon their particular talents or lack of talents. The operatives typically aren't people that can articulate themselves well or have an ability to adhere to and understand the ideology. I adopted a role very early on as a propagandist. We were connected to a large amount of cases. I think between mid-2008-2009, 23 terrorism cases came up and we were directly connected to seven of them. And that's direct connection. You can't measure ideas and you can't measure influence.
Tonight in The Briefing Room, we'll hear about Jesse Morton's extraordinary journey into and back out of extremism. His is a story about how one of the most important jihadist networks in the West radicalized many young people and set them on a path towards terrorism. Jesse Morton was a poor white kid from a bad home. Beaten by his mother, he ran away at the age of 16 and lived by selling drugs outside Grateful Dead concerts. His conversion to Islam and eventually to radical extremism started in jail in Virginia.
The first time I had contact with Islam politicized in a jihadist perspective was during the early part of my conversion. I was incarcerated after committing a minor offense, and a Moroccan individual there that had recently immigrated and found himself in trouble but planned on, this is prior to 9/11, joining the Taliban in Afghanistan upon his release, sat me down and gave me an explanation of these hadith, or the statements of the Prophet Muhammad that are apart from the Quran, about this black flag that would be raised from Khorasan in Afghanistan, and he predicted that the West would eventually be drawn into a war between the Muslims. And he really helped set me off on this trajectory of understanding the world in a black and white way.
The whole world one day, my dear brothers, will be under the Sharia, including Hackney and Walthamstow and Moscow and New York, all of the country, inshallah.
A Manichean worldview echoed in Britain by Anjem Chowdhury of the group Al Muhajiroon.
Next time, when your child is at school and the teacher says, what do you want when you grow up? What is your ambition? They should say, to dominate the whole world by Islam, including Britain. That is my ambition.
Al Muhajiroon had inspired a US spin-off called the Islamic Thinkers Society. It was this group that Jesse joined when he left prison and headed for New York. At online gatherings, Jesse heard Anjem Chowdhury preach regularly. Like its British counterpart, the Islamic Thinker Society did a lot of its proselytising openly in the streets. That's how Jesse came into contact with them. And they were experts at staying within the law, helped by the First Amendment, America's constitutional commitment to freedom of speech.
The First Amendment is very, very useful with regard to propagating radical ideas. We espoused heinous and horrendous views. And the American legal system gave us the ability to do that. And on one hand, that's something that you would think that a jihadist would notice the contradictions in, you know, but for some reason, it doesn't really ring a bell. But we basically studied the case law on free speech and knew exactly what we were able to do and what we weren't able to do. And we would challenge that border.
It was a borderline that he positively hugged. Here's Morton speaking to Radio 4 in 2011.
Just because somebody visits a domain name on the World Wide Web does not mean that I enabled them or sent them or encouraged them to do anything. Our position on terrorism is this. We neither condone it nor condemn it, because until the West is ready, willing, and able to talk about their terrorism, then we're not willing to have that conversation.
It was a tactic not confined to the U.S.
It's something that I think all movements are conscious of. I mean, look at Anjem Chowdhury, who was recently convicted. How long was he preaching? Almost 25 years, openly, and connected to a large number of terrorist events and attempted terrorist events, incarcerations, people traveling overseas, and it took forever. In the early days, part of my radicalization was online, and I remember sitting down and sometimes spending like 10 hours in a row listening to like 8 lectures and just basically becoming drunk on the ideology.
So let's back up for a moment. I wanted to know more about the process of radicalization, which Jesse Morton told me happens in 3 stages. The first stage was to convince the subject that, integral to the concept of monotheism, the idea that there is only one God, was the extra belief that God should be the only legislator.
All Muslims, in order to be considered proper Muslims, have to be monotheistic. But this politicizes this concept of monotheism by inserting this notion that if one does not believe that God is the only legislator, the only lawgiver, and one does not have complete adherence to the Sharia and a desire to live under Sharia and to establish Sharia, then one is in fact not actually a monotheist, so therefore he cannot actually be a Muslim.
The second concept was known as the rejection of false gods, again a seemingly straightforward proposition common to mainstream Islam and other religions. But groups like Jesse's extend this rejection to anyone or any government who does not adhere to their interpretation of Sharia. So if you believe, let's say, that an intervening state has the right to set laws, then in that case you're not a proper monotheist.
If you participate in any way in secularism or democracy, and that's one of the branches of this root conversation, this idea that not only allows you to consider everyone outside of Islam, you know, an enemy, but it also creates this idea that those that don't adhere aren't in fact Muslims at all. Those two principles allow you to branch off into many different political discourses, because the first one basically separates your understanding of Islam from every other understanding of Islam, and it makes you a special Muslim as opposed to a general Muslim. It also imparts upon you this idea that the religion, as revealed to Muhammad, is still applicable in the 21st century.
So those entail, effectively, a rejection of all existing, of almost all existing forms of government.
Every single person who rules by other than what Allah has revealed, who doesn't want to implement Sharia law in its totality, whether they be a democratic regime, whether they be a communist regime, or whether they be someone like Saudi Arabia, who, as jihadis see it, portrays themselves as implementing Sharia law, but because they violate certain principles, for example, they participate in the United Nations or they allow international financial institutions to implement usury or interest-based banking on the kingdom, that in some way, shape, or form nullifies their very Islam and justifies a rebellion against them. And that all ties into the third principle that's used to radicalize an individual, which is al-wala wal-bara, which means that all of your allegiance is for the Muslims alone, that your allegiance is only for the Muslims, and in this case, based upon the first two principles, it's only an allegiance to the real Muslims. And al-bara means that you must make your animosity or your hatred against everything that opposes your allegiance to the Muslims. And so basically what this allows you to do is set up that us versus them mentality that takes you away from any influence outside of the group. And after that, you basically enter a cult.
Wants to conquer your land, conquer your resources, kill your brothers, maim your sisters, rape your sisters, and drop bombs on your children, and you have nothing to say.
Believe it or not, that was Jesse Morton 7 years ago. It hardly sounds like the same man.
To hell with democracy! To hell with America! To hell with nationalism! To hell with Barack Obama! To hell with every ideology, ism, and schism that does not agree with Islam!
Jesse Morton's radical journey led him, in 2007, to start the group Revolution Muslim, along with two other men. Youssef Al-Khattab was an Orthodox Jew who converted to Islam. Morton says the two were best friends. Their spiritual leader was a Jamaican cleric and former British resident, Abdullah El-Faisal. He was connected to a number of plots. Among his followers were two of the 7/7 bombers, and Faisal had been convicted of inciting racial hatred in the UK against Jews, Hindus and Americans, and spent 4 years in prison here before being deported in 2007.
Upon Sheikh Faisal's release, he contacted me, and we started to discuss possibly inserting the ideology of Al-Qaeda or the jihadist ideology into the American ambit. We did start with the intention of utilizing new internet platforms to propagate the message. However, we also maintained this idea that we had to sort of emulate al-Muhajirun's approach, which we had learned from their offshoot in New York, which was to set up stalls, what they called dawah stalls, provocative imagery, and to engage in provocative events.
Jesse, what was the purpose of that particular thing? You've got your online presence. Was it because you would take YouTube videos of these stalls, etc., or would it be because these stalls would sometimes be passed by possible recruits?
Number one, it's a tool for recruitment. It also was a fundraising mechanism. Surprisingly enough, we always found our donation cup very full. Anybody could access Al-Qaeda's ideology, but we were the first, I think, to really bring it into the public realm and just put it out there without necessarily fear of consequence.
Well, you gave it an American accent, really, didn't you?
I mean, that's the best way to describe it. I think that's a perfect way to put it.
You want Barack Obama to save your condition. You don't mind if Afghani civilians are bombed every day. As long as it's not your house. As long as it's not your daughter. As long as it's not your children. You are content to stay silent.
That was Jesse Morton and Revolution Muslim giving it out loudly outside a New York mosque. You talk about these things as a strategy. Were there moments when you had either sat down and developed this strategy, or had you picked up that strategy from people active, say, in Britain, from people like Anjem Chowdhury and so on?
Well, I think we learned the key principles of organizing as a protest movement, I guess you could say, or as a social movement, from the al-Muhajirun leadership directly. And I learned that and adopted that when I was with the Islamic Thinkers Society prior to formulating Revolution Muslim. And so what would happen in that circle is that you would engage in weekly classes or discussion groups. Occasionally, what they would do, like once every 3 weeks or so, is they would stream Anjem Chowdhury or another lower-level leader into the room that you were studying in the United States. So that gave you direct contact with the leadership. But as far as the organization goes, you have al-Muhajirunists in the UK that have already set a precedent with the Dawah stalls, with the provocative protests, with the imagery. A lot of the literature we used was the same. And we stole from that a bit and advanced upon it in many ways.
Amazingly, their message found an audience and no one interfered.
The phenomenon of lone wolf terrorism wasn't yet understood as the primary threat to the United States. And the idea was that the United States was immune from domestic terrorist attacks from homegrown violent extremists. We were well aware that the American ambit was quite ready for the enhanced propaganda of the jihadist message. So the very first case that came out against us was a woman that they dubbed in the media as Jihad Jane. And she was a subscriber to our YouTube channel, as simple as that. We had no real direct contact, but it is apparent that she was influenced by our ideology, and she attempted to engage in a plot to kill Lars Vilk, an individual who was on the hit list for portraying the Prophet Muhammad. So
in Sweden.
In Sweden, yes. From there, there was slowly a trickle-down effect. At the same time, the Somalian jihadi group Al-Shabaab was starting to make significant gains in Mogadishu.
Al-Shabaab was the big jihadi thing at that time and became a focal point of Revolution Muslim propaganda. Some ethnic Somalis in America began to become radicalized and traveled back to fight for the extremists. Along with them were other non-Somali Muslims like Omar Hamami, who became a charismatic spokesman for Al-Shabaab before falling out with them, fatally.
The only reason we're staying here, away from our families, away from the cities, away from, you know, ICE, candy bars, all these other things, is because we're waiting to meet with the enemy. So, inshallah, we're from the Murabitin, and we're going to get the reward of Ribat.
Omar Hamami left around the same time that we started, but I do remember that, you know, he had a best friend that converted to Islam in Alabama, where he was from, and he had basically been paying attention to Omar Hamami's propaganda online. He reached out and said he wanted to join Al-Shabaab, and this is, again, the idea of walking a fine line. If I tell him to join Al-Shabaab, I broke the law. Instead, I told him, you know, you should go to college and get educated. But I sent him many attachments on the email from scholars that encouraged making hijra or migrating to Land of Islam. He never went. There was ultimately intervention.
But you wouldn't have been at all surprised to discover he did. And in that stage in your incarnation, you wouldn't have been at all disappointed.
Not even a little bit.
That was the way it worked. Stay on the right side of the law, just. In Britain, extremists praised the Afghan Taliban, but not the Pakistani Taliban. Why? Because the former were not proscribed as a terrorist organisation, but the latter were. Then, give the recruits the desire and contacts to make jihad, but don't actually tell them to go. Then, sit back and watch the mayhem. Eventually, however, even Jesse got caught out. One of his acolytes decided to target the writers of the satirical cartoon series South Park for supposed blasphemy. In the run-up to this plot, never carried out, Jesse had posted inciting material on his Revolution Muslim website. It was enough to get him convicted. He was sentenced to 11 and a half years. Jesse Morton was in prison when in 2013 Omar Hamami was killed in Somalia. By then, Morton's de-radicalisation was well underway. What started the process, he says, was his time in Morocco when he saw that young people didn't want jihad but rather liberal Western democracy. And after his arrest, he was treated with respect and sometimes even kindness by his American jailers. He was given a copy of the Quran upon his arrest. He was allowed extra library time, which he used to read classic liberal texts by the likes of Locke and John Stuart Mill. Eventually, he changed sides. He started to confide in a woman FBI agent who'd been kind to him, and then went on to work as an undercover government informant, both in prison and after he was released early, until a court case and a report in the Washington Post earlier this year blew his cover. As Jesse's days as an active jihadi ended, the extremist focus moved on, from Somalia to Syria. Has anybody who's had any contact or influence, been influenced by you, ever gone out to Syria, made any kind of contact with you?
I'm really not allowed to talk specifically about some of the influences that I had, at least not at this point. But I do know that several of my key students would reach out while I was incarcerated to, you know, applaud my sacrifice in the way of Islam and to retain contact and to let me know that they had indeed traveled to Iraq, to Syria, to Lebanon, to Libya. And, of course, as part of my de-radicalization process, contact with law enforcement led me to cooperation. And I was able to receive emails. And so I watched the whole process unfold via email.
How did you feel about that?
It was difficult to deal with, especially from inside of a jail cell where you're operating clandestinely and you have very few people to talk to. In March of 2015, I remember Ramadan when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi climbed the pedestal in Mosul and announced that the Khilafah had been reestablished. All of a sudden, a couple of weeks later, I got emails from individuals just talking about how wonderful it was. One person said that he celebrated Eid by swimming in the Euphrates River with brothers from all over the West. Many of them had mentioned that your propaganda influenced them greatly, and they send their regards. And then he talked about how he was sure that there wasn't going to be any problems in Mosul because they had hung the heads of those that were decapitated on the gates outside the city to warn all spies and to warn those that collaborated. It sent shivers down my spine, essentially. But the final concluding statement that he made was, I don't know of any brothers that are going to engage in quote-unquote tourism to the United States. We're not entitled to knowing specific plans. But I can say that the brothers that are here are from all over the world. They're crazier and more dangerous than anyone could imagine. And no one would even suspect that they have joined us. And instantly, images of body parts on streets like the Boston Marathon bombings came into my head. This is a monster that you helped to create. How can I feel anything but remorse now that I've altered my views? It was a difficult process. But in the end of the day, I was able to, contribute to making sure that some of those things, didn't happen that I envisioned in my brain.
Jesse Morton, still a Muslim and now an academic at George Washington University, is an active part of this battle. But how important is he? Now joining me in the briefing room is Dominic Casciani, the BBC's Home Affairs correspondent, who's been closely following the activities and then the trial of Anjem Chowdhury for years. I started by asking him about Morton's significance.
I think this is one of the clearest insights we've yet had into the workings of what is loosely called the Al-Muhajirun Network. Now, I know he's met MI5. I know he's met people from the UK who are desperate to get inside his head and get at this gold mine of information he had about the extremist networks on both sides of the Atlantic. Jesse Morton, in many respects, was the mirror image in the United States of Anjem Chowdhury here in the UK. And this is about a network which goes across the Atlantic, it goes across continents, and how these people find each other and slowly over years and years build up relationships, links to other organisations and individuals who are willing to take that final step towards violence, and how they use each other and reinforce their worldview. So I think he's a very, very significant figure.
From a British point of view, what have we learned from him about about Chowdhury's organisation and his modus operandi?
What you see is that radicalisation through this organisation, which has been hunted for years, particularly by Scotland Yard here, is it's not about radicalization in mosques or madrasas, those kind of sort of tabloid stereotypes. This is effectively a cult that draws people in, and it's about controlling people's lives. And if you take Jesse's story, you know, Jesse found this organization in the United States, it's equivalent in the US. He allowed himself to become part of it. They began to control his life. He began to go to the study circles. That reinforced his worldview. He cut off his contacts with people outside of that worldview. He then took part in international online lectures involving people like Anjem Chowdhury here in the UK and others in other parts of the world. So this was as cultish as it comes, because you are inside the organization and everybody outside is an enemy, and that reinforces how they worked. It's self-reinforcing. And we've seen this time and again with Anjem Chowdhury's British recruits. They get inside the organization and it's very, very difficult for them to leave or to actually understand when they want to leave themselves. Some of these people have doubts, but very few come out the other end.
Well, what I found extraordinary about him, Dominic, was the ease with which he slipped into all of this.
And I think that in many respects is one of the terrifying things. If you look at the networks he became involved with, you ask yourself the question, did they find him or did he find them? And I think it's probably a little bit of both. Clearly, Jesse Morton was looking for some kind of answer to his own life. And then bada bing, one day he finds these guys. They fit the worldview he's already formed, his hatred of the West, his hatred of American liberalism and liberal democracy, and he's there. He's a way down that journey, isn't he?
What did you feel you'd learn from him about the difference in the way in which British and Americans deal with the recanting jihadi?
In terms of Jesse, you know, in Jesse's case, there were clearly four or five triggers which led him to change his worldview. One of them was quite simply starting to realise that some of the arguments he personally believed in just didn't make any sense at the end of the day. Another key one, and I think this is really important, is he started to see people being kind to him. He started to realise that Western liberalism wasn't this great big evil, and he started to read whilst in solitary confinement. So he was reading the great works of Western Enlightenment. And this opened his mind. And once that you get that chink in there, once you start to open someone's mind, you have that opportunity to challenge an extremist worldview and get people to turn back. If you look at what's going to happen to Anjem Chowdhury, he's going to be sentenced next week. And the first thing almost certainly they will do in prison is isolate him because of the danger he poses. How that isolation will work, we're not quite sure. But if they get the opportunity, the state, the prison service and the Home Office, MI5, everybody will throw everything they can at trying to change this man's worldview. Because if they can do it for someone like Jesse Morton, and if someone like Jesse Morton can change themselves, well, maybe it can be done for someone like Anjem Chowdhury as well.
Right at the end of our interview, I asked Jesse Morton about the future. During all this, you must have thought to yourself on certain occasions, if I were the authorities, this is what I'd do about me and about this situation. Have we in the West been clever about how to deal with the sorts of groups that you're talking about? Or have we got still a lot to learn?
It's a very difficult question to answer because the argument against trying to intervene with gateway organizations is that they're useful in some ways because they allow you to monitor who comes and interacts with them. They allow they sort of serve as a and facilitate law enforcement work. But we're not looking at the process or the role of organizations that serve as a conveyor belt, as many have put it.
How big a challenge do you think this is for Western society?
This is essentially, as David Cameron put it, the struggle of our generation. I mean, this idea, as Malcolm Gladwell put it in his very famous book, The Tipping Point, ideas are like viruses, and this thing has gone viral. And until we have a better way of struggling against an idea, we won't be able to resolve the root of the conflict. And I also think that we need to incorporate an understanding that it's not just about who they are, but it's also about who we are. Liberal democracy and liberalism in general is a narrative that is very powerful that we're not utilizing. We talk a lot about counter-messaging. Until we make the message of jihadists the counter-message to our message, then ultimately we won't be able to win the war.
That's it from The Briefing Room this week. My thanks to Jesse Morton and to Dominic Casciani.
That was David Aronovich presenting The Briefing Room. The program was produced by me, Mike Wendling. Innes Bowen was the editor. And if you like this program, you might also like the podcast version of Crossing Continents, also from BBC Radio 4. The most recent episode is about America's heroin epidemic and how it's affecting one small community in Ohio. Thanks very much for listening.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.